Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast for veterinarians, healthcare providers, and busy professionals who want actionable, implementable solutions surrounding work-life balance, accomplishing your goals, and living your dreams. I'm your host, Dr. Angela Demery.
We are here today with John Stoy. After years of climbing the Wall Street corporate ladder, John, a financial advisor, became disillusioned with false promises of outperforming the market. He eventually started a sushi delivery company, only to return to his first love, financial planning. But this time, things are different. With Verbatim Financial, John's gone rogue with his pricing model and is applying his decades of experience and personal touch to help clients simplify their financial lives. John believes sincerely that done well and delivered fairly, good financial advice is more valuable than its cost and worth buying. Unfortunately, he also knows firsthand that banks, broker-dealers, insurance companies, and the like often have their profits rather than their customers' best interests in mind. So, John, what an incredible career transition. And if I'm not mistaken, you were also a stay-at-home dad for a little bit.
I sure was, yeah. I ended up spending the first, I suppose it would be 3 to 4 years of my son's life at home, mainly because of my wife. My wife is a physician, so she shouldered that burden and continues to do so. But that was a rewarding time for sure, but interesting.
Yes. Never a dull moment there, I'm sure. So tell us, what was it like to go from managing an investment portfolio of almost $4 billion, being wined and dined by Wall Street, to then starting your own business and becoming an entrepreneur, and then transitioning to be a stay-at-home dad?
Yeah, it's so funny, right? When you're doing any of these things, they don't seem like they're that crazy at the time, but when you look back, it can often seem a little startling, and I definitely feel that way about my own journey. But I like to sort of classify myself as a reluctant entrepreneur. After the financial crisis, back in, you know, about 10 years ago, I had a couple of business opportunities basically shuttered by decisions that I wasn't in control of. Let's put it that way. The government decisions, banking decisions. And I just got tired of it. I got tired of it. And I have a personality that tends to want to push back against the norm or the accepted. And so I said, that's it. That's the last time I put all this blood, sweat, and tears into these businesses. And then decisions by people, you know, hundreds of miles away or wherever, have impacted my life. And so I said, what can I do that I could have more control over my own life? And at the time, and I think of this now as we're all dealing with COVID and nobody can go out to eat. And they can't even, they're taking deliveries, but it's a different world. But at the time, 10 years ago, I thought to myself, well, everybody likes food. Everybody needs food. And so the food business seemed like something that I could get involved in. I love food. And I had a friend from business school who had started a sushi, fast food sushi company. And so he wanted to expand and I wanted to do something. And so he said, well, would you like to open up a restaurant in Atlanta, which is where I am. And his other units were in Kansas City and Virginia. And I said, well, here's the thing. I don't know anything about the restaurant business. It makes me really nervous. We all know the statistics about restaurant failures. I said, but I feel like I can set up a business to produce something, and I can sell it. And so that's how we ended up with the sushi production and delivery company, because sushi is a fantastic product from that respect, because if you buy the right ingredients, fresh, the only thing that you cook is the rice, really. And so you can train people with good knife skills to put the sushi together. It's an assembly process. And so we set up a big commercial kitchen with three assembly lines, and learned how to safely package and deliver fresh sushi for corporate clients. And so that was my life for almost 5 years. it was something else.
Wow, that's so incredibly fascinating and such an interesting transition into the entrepreneurial world. Then you transitioned to being a stay-at-home dad for a few years, and now you're back being an entrepreneur again in the financial world. Is mm-hmm. that right?
It is. So I was very lucky with the sushi business to sell it. A lot of food businesses, you know, they'll just go out of business, or the owners will shut them down because your patrons are often dependent upon you. You're the face of the business. That's the small food businesses. That's often the case. In my case, in what I had done, was set the business up so that I created a book of business that was regular customers that basically had contracts of business for us. And so when I went to sell it, I could point to this ongoing business that these clients would not care whether John Stoy was sitting there or not. And so so I was able to sell it. And that was a decision we made after my son was born. My wife and I, after the umpteenth day of maybe she was on call and I got a phone call from one of the guys at work saying, boss, we're out of avocados. And, you know, I'd have to get out of bed and try to find the Restaurant Depot all night avocado store type of thing in order to get the production ready for the next day. Meanwhile, you know, we had a 3 to 6 month old in the other room. Doesn't really work for a life work life balance, and so I was lucky enough to sell that, and as you mentioned, you know, stay at home for a while. But after our son got into kindergarten, we decided that it was time that I could get back, you know, at least into the workforce, give something back again to the community, because that's really what I wanted to do, and to do something that was still, again, you know, I'll go back to that work-life balance thing. I think it's a little unrealistic idea, right? The idea of having it all, that's a little unrealistic, but ideally we could maybe set up a situation where it's a little better than being forced to go into the office every day and waiting for your boss to leave before you can leave and things like that. And that sure doesn't work when you're trying to manage a young boy at home.
I'm just really curious. So many of us, we go through different career transitions, or we're worried that, you know, maybe we won't be able to get back into careers if we stay at home to care for our children. And we read all of the stats and the data for working moms and all of the difficulties. What did you find to be the most helpful to navigate these career transitions and then to re-enter the workforce? What did you find was the most useful to you?
I think that the most important thing for me was basically staying in touch with the business, whatever business that would be whatever business you're in. And then in my case, it was the financial markets and things like that. And so even when I was at home and knew I wouldn't be working, you know, for a while, I would still get, my friends would still email me research or articles, or, you know, just simply reading things on the internet and Wall Street Journal type of thing. And so I always kept up. And then keeping your network alive. And I think that, you know, there's a reason why there's so many books on it and podcasts and TV shows. Networking is so, it's really difficult, and it is a job. But if you let it go, that can be trouble, because then people do think you're gone, you know, and they'll forget about you. And when you try to call them up for advice or potentially, you know, a job, you know, in after some period of time, that will be more difficult. But if you keep up your relationships, then it's I think it's a different story. because work relationships aren't like friendships, right? We all talk about our best friend, and this is true. I mean, I'm sure we all have them. My friend from college that I haven't seen for a long time, and I sent him a note the other day. I had a business coach ask me to send out a note. I sent a note out, and he responded, and then we talked, you know, again, like the old story, like we had never been apart. Work friends aren't like that, and so you have to work to keep up those relationships. And so that was something that helped for sure.
Yes, great advice. And I'm so glad you mentioned that with keeping up our networks, because it can so easily become overlooked, especially with young kids at home who in a family and all of these other dynamics needing our attention for sure. So being really intentional about that. Thank you for sharing that great piece of advice. And now transitioning back into what you're doing now with professional and personal finance, how can small business owners defend themselves against Wall Street while still getting professional advice without breaking the bank?
So thank you for setting me up with that question. Which I know that you read my bio. So this is something that, and it's really the reason why I did get back into this sector of finance. My first part of my financial career, I was all on the institutional side. I worked for big companies, investment banks like Nomura Securities and Bank One and ING Investment Management, SunTrust. These are, you know, big companies managing money for big funds and things like that. And the thing was, there's a lot of the jokes about Wall Street and also the movies. There's a lot of truth to some of that boiler room kind of stuff. And so if you're on a trading desk and I would hear the traders talk about, literally, they would use the term, oh, I ripped that guy's face off when I did a trade with him. And it was funny and fun and competitive. But you were talking about nameless financial institutions. I didn't think that much of it. Looking back, I probably should have, but at the time I sure didn't. But on the personal finance side, when people want to get financial advice from advisors, people that peddle themselves as financial advisors, what I discovered was that there are a lot more people on that side of the business who think the exact same way as the institutional side of the business. And so, but the problem with that is that every dollar you take away from a client is then a dollar that you're taking away from your client's retirement and future. And so I had a real problem with that. And it dissuaded me from getting into this part of the business for a couple of years, because of people that suggested that to me, especially when I started making inquiries about, well, geez, you know, my son's going to be going to school. I'm thinking about going back, you know, to work. You know, what do you think I should do? I'd talk to my people that may have been my mentors and stuff like that. And they would suggest that I should get into personal money management and wealth management and things like that. And I looked into that side of the business, and there, like I said, there was just too much that I didn't like about it. But I kept digging, and I discovered that there is a small cadre, small but growing, group of financial advisors who are doing things differently. And the different thing is making a genuine attempt to take all conflicts of interest out of the financial advisory business. And that's the biggest thing. That so it's a complicated business. It's simple and yet not easy at all, because there's so many ways for fees to get hidden, and ways for basically Wall Street and the advisors who work for Wall Street to make a ton of money. And the only way they're making money is by clients not keeping as much of it. And so my goal, again, is to allow my clients to keep as much of their own money as possible, and to never worry or second guess as to why I might give them a certain piece of advice.
And so this holds true probably whether you're a small business owner or when you're talking about individual and personal finance. So what are some things specifically to watch out for when looking to hire a financial advisor from your perspective?
So there's basically, you know, it's very popular now, and it's a good thing in the business that people have sort of, they understand that commissions are generally not a good thing in the financial advisory business because of the commissions are going to encourage salespeople to sell the thing that pays them the most money. I get that. We all have to pay our mortgage and feed our family. And if you're a salesperson, that's what you're going to do. And that doesn't make you a bad person. But in the case where you're working with somebody's potential retirement savings, it's problematic for sure. And so that's a good thing. The business has gotten away from that to a large degree, with the exception of, say, insurance companies and insurance salesmen. But they moved towards what they call fee only over the last couple decades, and fee only, and they use the term fiduciary, and you've probably heard of that one. But fiduciary simply means, it's a fancy word for meaning that you're only supposed to act in your customer's best interest. So if you don't take commissions and you only take a fee, then you're allowed to say you're a fiduciary and you act in your customer's best interest. The problem with that is most of the advisors who operate under that rubric also use a fee structure called assets under management, where they take a percentage, usually around 1% of their clients' assets in their fee every year. And that may seem like a reasonable deal. And if somebody has, $500,000 under management with somebody and the fee is $5,000 a year, that's probably pretty reasonable. But the thing is, the fee doesn't go down. It only goes up as your investments go up, through your own, contributions or the market pushing it up. And so suddenly, if you have $1 million, that's a $10,000 fee. And if it goes up, it just continues rising until it becomes quite egregious. And so what we've done is I am a flat fee advisor. And so my clients get charged one fee and they know exactly what that fee is going to be every year, despite, no matter what happens with their investments. And if their investments grow, fantastic, because the markets, are rewarding them. And so the way that people, if they're looking for an advisor, there's basically two questions that I think are most important. They drill down to the bottom. It doesn't matter whether an advisor says they're going to sign a fiduciary oath or something like that, which is very popular again nowadays. But the first question is simple: how are you paid? And if you go to, I've read statistics saying upwards of 85% of advisor websites don't even list how they are paid on their websites. So it's very opaque. You have to list your fees, but you have to register those with the SEC, and then people have to go, into the government to find those documents. It's a pain. So how are you paid? And then also number two, how much in total advisory fees and investment costs will I pay? Because it's also quite popular to sell certain funds that have higher fees, and those fees do get back to the companies somehow, and those fees, get back to the advisor. So it's all different ways of essentially having more money leave your pocketbook and your savings.
That's really interesting. So how do we ask that second question again? So first, how do you get paid?
Right.
And then two, to make sure that you're not missing any of the money that's going to leave your accounts. How did you phrase that again?
I said, how much in total advisory fees and investment costs will I pay?
And so investment costs, I think, are
that's the key. That's there, a key bit. Yep. Advisory fees and investment costs, because, you'll get to the point where some folks will, I'll call it nickel and dime their own clients, because it's not a costless thing for an advisor such as myself to set up a new client on their custodian's platform. It might just be $200, but that's part of my I view that as part of my operating expenses. There are businesses, there are advisory businesses who put that fee back onto their client. They try to basically make themselves as close to a zero operating fee or operating expense business as they possibly can. But what that means is all that is coming out of their clients' pockets. If you say that your client, like in my case, it's quite simple. It's smack there in the middle of my website. My clients, they want ongoing advisory. It's $5,000 a year, and they know that. And it doesn't matter if they have a tough year, that maybe they have a bunch of extra work because maybe there was death in the family, or maybe there wasn't a big inheritance. That doesn't matter. That's part of what I should be providing any client. And so it's not like I'm going to charge them extra for that. And if they, and again, back to the flat fee versus say an assets under management, if a client, say, you know, long lost uncle leaves them $10 million, well, there's no reason for my fee to go from whatever, from $5,000 to $55,000 or $105,000 or whatever the number would be based upon some percentage of money.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting way of looking at it. And quite frankly, a very service-oriented, service-facing way of looking at that too, because I'm sure people argue it from the other side, like even clients, right? Well, what if I don't have that much yet? You know, what if my assets 1%, you know, doesn't even get to 5,000 yet? But, and you know, 1%, man, a rising tide lifts all boats, right? 1% is not that much, right? It can mm-hmm. add up to a total dollar amount for sure, but looking at it from that perspective, but then also there may be additional hidden fees as you mentioned too. I'm just curious, like, is it that the flat fee is just like, this is what you're getting, this is all the services you're getting, and this is how much it costs, and it doesn't matter how much. Is it possible, like, do you have to do more work if it's more money, or is it still pretty much the same number of things that you're doing regardless? I guess I'm trying to understand from a service perspective. You can see, like, there's a lot of dynamics that really go into that.
Yeah. Oh, there is. There have been studies made where that creating a financial plan, a comprehensive financial plan, for a client costs an advisor in terms of their time and effort. I think the numbers I've seen somewhere around $3,500. Then the effort it takes to set up portfolios, monitor them, manage them, that also costs time and effort. And then you have to build in a little profit, like any business is. You know, there ought to be a little bit of profit in there for the business. But we have this technology nowadays that it really isn't any more work to manage. Again, I'll use that 500,000 versus 5 million, because of the other thing that many advisors sell is they, and Wall Street, I'll call it Wall Street as opposed to advisors, Wall Street sells on complexity. And this is another thing that I bring to the table. I used to, my career was designing, and then after that, managing portfolios of some of the most complicated investment securities that they've created. I was a CDO manager, to the extent that you've heard of that. People heard of it for a while, again, about 10 years ago, because CDOs are collateralized debt obligations. They were the securities that started the crash of the financial services market and the financial markets 10 years ago. Way too complicated. I was a programmer. I created these vast models in order to create these bonds to sell. And the more complicated you made it, the more money you as the bank could make off of it, because you could slice it and dice it and upcharge every single time you did another slice and dice. Well, on the personal side, the more complicated the portfolio that an advisor might create for a client, you know, that might be a lot of work, but it's also, in my view, unnecessary work. I'm a big believer in simplicity, what they call passive investment versus active investment, active management. it goes back to my computer programming days and my statistician's mind. There is very little data that shows active management ever outperforming the market on a long-term basis. You'll always find people that can do it. And you can often find people that can do it for a 3-4 maybe 5-year period, but when you extend past that, the numbers dwindle quickly. And the most important thing is saving, investing, planning your financial life versus picking a stock or a set of stocks. And it's my opinion that especially busy people, that's something that takes away from their ability to devote their time to other things. And if they hand that responsibility to an advisor, then at least don't hand it to an advisor who's going to make the same mistakes.
Well stated, for sure. And was it John Vogel that made some of this really popular? Was that like the stock market always goes up over time, so we should really just be investing in the United States instead of all of the additional, perhaps unnecessary complexity with
yes. Tax. Oh my gosh, yes. And you bring up, one of my heroes, Bogle. I don't think I qualify as a Boglehead, but the way his coming up with the first index funds, low cost, I use and recommend people look into Vanguard funds because they are not only low fee, but they're also they have their tax advantage as well. They have a good tax structure, I should say. And one of the guys that is also a Boglehead and is a gentleman named Rick Ferry. The way he puts it, I think, is great. Simply being invested in the market is, I think the last number I heard was like 84%. Contributes 84% of your return over time. So that's he likes to put it, that's the cake. And so everything else between that 84% and trying to get to the 100% of your return to try to attribute the reasons behind or the things that led to what return you got, everything else is icing. And then it gets to the point where you're maybe just thinking about not only icing, but sprinkles. It's not that important. You could add in, of course, you could add in international. Of course, you could try to slice and dice, and people talk about all these things, small cap value, growth, all these things. It, again, to me, and some people love that. And if they want to work with an advisor who's going to do that for them, hey, great. As long as the advisor isn't charging them too much, that's great. My view, again, keep it as simple as possible, as few funds as possible. And I find that, you know, as an advisor, especially having started this business, my business, and having gotten back into it right before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, what I found was that the clients that I had who had signed up with me and had sort of bought into this idea that we don't control the markets. I surely don't control them. All we can do is try to control what we can within our lives, and that's saving, doing the right thing, making the right plans. Now, those plans might include changing your risk allocations depending upon what happens within your life or within the world, but it surely doesn't depend on or it surely shouldn't tell you sell this investment now, buy that investment later, do this, do that. All of that is a very difficult thing to ever win consistently at.
Yeah, and I don't know what your experience was. You know, you're definitely helping a lot more clients, have a lot more viewpoints perhaps on different life experiences than I do, just thinking about my own personal finances. But boy, I'm sure glad I did nothing, because it all, like, I think, you know, today, yesterday, like when I look from 6 months ago, like we're back to square one where I started. And so sometimes doing nothing and then deciding, you know, okay, for the, you know, future, what are we doing, might even be the best advice. I don't know.
Well, certainly it did work out that way this time quite quickly. in the past. It didn't work out quite as quickly, but as you said, as Bogle and other people have pointed out, the markets have gone up over time historically, pretty consistently. And you really lose when you don't participate in investment and savings in the market. And that's one of the things that I do bring to the table. I'm going to say there's definitely advisors out there who are smarter than me. There's advisors out there who are younger than me. But one of the things that I can bring to the table to my clients is the view that I've had from the seats that I've had over the course of time. I'm not, 75 years old, but I started my first job in Wall Street in on a trading desk in 91. So it's a little while ago. I've seen a couple now, several of these downturns. And I probably have made every mistake that you would have made. Early on, I day traded. And one of my friends said it the other day, we were talking about it. He said, one of the worst things that could ever happen to a day trader is to be successful early on. And that's what happened to me. I did really well. So I assumed that I could manage my own money on a very active basis. And of course that petered out and eventually I ended up with a big loss. the other thing is getting scared. I did that 10 years ago. I never thought the market would recover the way it did. So I went fantastically conservative in terms of my investments, and it took me a long time to get the confidence that we were heading in the right direction economically again, and God knows what that cost me. And so I can talk through those types of things and many other situations that I experienced again in my positions on Wall Street, and then as a business owner with clients, and I think it helps them get a little more comfort with decisions that they have to make.
And so bottom line, don't panic. And then number two, find a financial advisor who shares your view of the world and is going to help you save for your future, for your retirement, to meet your personal and professional goals on the financial side. Is that fair?
It's more than fair. I think that's your ideal situation, because like I said before, I have a certain outlook. Other advisors have different outlooks. I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm just saying that this is what works for me and that I can explain to my clients. And the better an advisor or anybody in any business can explain what's happening to their client, the more comfortable their client is going to be. I'm sure you see the same thing, in your business. If somebody has a poor animal, they want to know exactly what's happening. It's one of those things.
Absolutely. If people want to learn more, where can they find you?
Definitely the easiest place is to go to verbatimfinancial.com. So the name of my firm is Verbatim Financial. And then on basically almost any social media platform, I'm there for good or ill.
Fair enough. And then as a financial advisor, can you work nationally, or are you limited to certain states or localities, or just for our listeners who might be spread across the United States, and even international audience as well?
Yeah, no. So I am in here in Atlanta, Georgia, and my firm is registered here, but I can work with clients in all of the 50 states and territories.
Great. So I'm grateful for the information and for you sharing that as well. And I guess now it's time for our 5 question segment. Are you ready, John?
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. So for question number 1, we know that the most successful and happy people have a morning or evening routine. What do you do each morning or evening that sets your day up for success?
So it's our coffee. And so my wife and I get up first. The alarm goes off at about 4:40 every morning because she heads into the hospital at 6. But I get up with her and I make the coffee, and we sit down and we watch 30 or so minutes of mindless TV. I mean, I admit it. We watch The Real Housewives. You know, we love building shows and renovation shows, the Flipper Flop, all that kind of stuff. But if we don't have our coffee and that mindless TV, and some every once in a while when that alarm doesn't go off accidentally and you end up rushing in the morning, I mean, forget it. That day is shot.
Yes. Oh, that's such a lovely, lovely routine there. And for questions number 2 and 3, I love to ask these questions separately because so often I think we conflate the idea of success and happiness, that when I achieve X success, then I will magically be happy. And we just know from the research that that isn't true. So for question number 2, what's your definition of success?
So mine is being able to do something that I feel confident doing, that I'm sort of always been somehow programmed to want to help folks. And so I want to contribute in some fashion. So if I'm doing that and I'm getting paid for it, then that's my definition of success. I make the joke, you know, I mean, I was at Wall Street, but I did not, you know, fly away with millions upon millions of dollars. So yes, I do need to pull in a paycheck. But as long as I'm getting paid something for doing something that I feel really good about, I'm happy. That's success.
Awesome. And for question number 3, what's your definition of happiness?
My definition of happiness is not needing to worry about my family. So like, if my family is happy, and I don't have to worry about their futures, then I'm happy.
Oh, that's so lovely. And for question number 4, what do you know now that you wish you would have known 10 years ago?
Oh, that's an easy one. I wish I had known that the markets would have recovered as quickly and as amazingly as they did. Other than that, everything else is just the kind of stuff that you learn on a day-to-day basis. And it's hard to say, if I had only known X, but on a purely financial standpoint, that I can do. I would not have left the markets or gone conservative.
And for question number 5, what do you think is the biggest issue facing busy professionals today?
I was mentioning it before. I'll go back to it. I'll have to say that work-life balance, because I don't know how people do it who say have kids and have 2 full-time working parents. I don't know how they do it. My wife and I would look at each other all the time when I wasn't working. And even now, the reason why my business is set up the way it is that I can control the number of clients I have in order to control the number of hours that I spend working on it. And even so, even during this COVID period, because of virtual schooling and all, I've had to pull quote unquote night shifts in order to do my actual work. God forbid if I had had a 9-to-5 or 7-to-7 job, which is what was the old yeah. Timing.
And I just love this idea that, and sometimes I think we look at work-life balance as everything has to be equal and sort of the time versus maybe the quality of time. So sometimes maybe imbalance is really balance depending on what your personal ideal is. Would that be a fair statement?
No, that makes total sense. And I mean, I've heard it explained about marriages in a way like that, which is that, you know, you can't think of marriages as 50-50 at any one point in time. Maybe over the course of 50 years, hopefully it averaged out to 50-50, but there's always going to be somebody who's doing, if it's not 51-49, it could be 60-40, 70-30, depending on what you're talking about. And that was something that, you know, that we... My wife and I, we got married later in life, in our 30s. And so we sort of had figured that, I don't want to say we figured it all out, but we figured at least that little bit of it out and allowed us to do what we've done. But I know that other people struggle with that a little more. And I don't want to leave people with the impression that it was super easy either. It was definitely weird. So there's a lot of still societal pressures on on men to be the breadwinner, and to you know, they're the ones going to work. I'll just say this one little thing, take too much time, but so we had to remind our son's school, I don't know how many times, to call me and not my wife if he had a sniffle or got scraped, you know, in the playground at school, because it's still so programmed to call the mom. And her phone would ring in the operating room, and you know, she'd see it was the school, but she'd be in the midst, you know, she's like, you got to call my husband. So these are kind of things. And it felt like it didn't matter how many times we told them. I think, you know, now by second grade, we're hoping that it's finally percolated through.
Yeah. And I'm so grateful that you shared this, because I'm a veteran, and a lot of women veterans, we all laugh and talk that, like, we go to the doctor and we say, oh, we've got TRICARE. and they say, well, what's your husband's social security number? And I'm like, I'm single. These are my civilian clothes. And like, I'm a professional, and I'm a major. And I'm like, well, here's my ID card. Is this what you're asking for? And they're like, oh, you know, you're not in uniform. And I'm like, I'm a reservist. Yeah. So, you know, there are all these societal pressures and norms. And I really appreciate you sharing that, because it doesn't matter if we're women or men, when we're filling maybe a non-traditional role from like the 1940s or the 1950s, like, we have work to do still with society that, you know, we can ebb and flow, and we just have to make it work for us. And we need to stop worrying about the societal pressures and norms and do what makes sense for us as busy professionals, as individuals, and as husbands and wives, or as partners and spouses.
I totally agree. Yeah, it's been that probably for me, stepping back, that was one of the things that was the most interesting to observe. You know, you could even see it. How would people react to you if you were at parties? And it's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, well, I'm, you know, helping raise my son right now, you know, and they're like, people don't know what to say. Things like that happen a lot. And as you mentioned, you know, my wife certainly experienced how many times it still happens to her. Well, she'll go into a patient's room and they'll be like, oh, when's my doctor coming in?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's there's like the never ending, and especially in networking settings or parties and things. And like, I'm single, and so I'm never really wanting to ask, oh, how's the family? And if you're just meeting someone for the first time, you don't already know like what their personal or professional life, you know, outside of professional life might be. And so I found like the best question to ask, and it's, what's your hobby? Because everybody loves talking about their hobbies, and it's so fun to watch people like light up. And it's usually a pretty benign question to ask, mm-hmm, unless mm-hmm. they're like, oh, I work all the time, I don't have any. So I'm like, you know, what's the one question we can ask without having like to wonder if we asked the right question, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a good one. I agree. I totally agree.
Do you have any favorites?
It's okay if you don't ask anybody about politics anymore. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. Well, John, I really appreciate this conversation, and thanks for letting us go a little bit off topic and learning a little bit more about you and your family and all of the wonderful insights you have as a busy professional who went from Wall Street to entrepreneurship to being a stay-at-home dad and back to running a small business. It was great to talk to you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too as well. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of Beyond the Stethoscope. I hope you are inspired to take actionable steps towards accomplishing your goals and living your dreams.